It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to the future of what's called green hydrogen and the potential for the universe's most abundant element in the clean energy mix as power companies work toward carbon neutral goals by 2050. Bring your questions on hydrogen, green hydrogen, 800-642-1234. Conversation right here, 800-642-1234. Paul Spicer is Senior Vice President of Power Generation for We Energies and Wisconsin Public Service, two of eight Midwest energy companies owned by Milwaukee-based WEC Energy Group. Paul, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Pleasure to be here.
Good morning. So WEC Energy announced it had successfully burned this blend of hydrogen and natural gas to create electricity. What is the significance of this project?
Thank you. For about 2 weeks in mid-October, we took one of our power generating facilities up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, one of the facilities that's really designed primarily with reliability in mind. We call it dispatchable, meaning it's capable of on-demand electricity for serving our customers, particularly when other sources wouldn't be available. For example, if the wind isn't blowing or the sun isn't shining, these on-demand sources step in and allow us to reliably serve our customers. Today, they work with natural gas, which is primarily methane, and in the future, the kind of post-2030 and beyond, the vision is if we have sources of hydrogen available, particularly hydrogen that are made from renewable resources, and you use the term green hydrogen.
Yes,
that's what
green
defines
hydrogen.
The green and mm-hmm. Exactly. That's what defines the green and green hydrogen. What we wanted to see is, does our existing infrastructure able to use that fuel? And if so, how far can we go without making modifications to those existing plants? So up in the UP, we have some internal combustion engines, and we blended hydrogen up to 25% hydrogen, 75% natural gas. And we were able to do that without significant modification to show that, in fact, even today, we'd be able to displace significant amounts of natural gas or methane with hydrogen. Of course, as innovations continue and as research continues and things like hydrogen hubs get stood up around the country, that hydrogen will become more available and we'll make progress in being able to blend higher blends than 25 to 75.
Right. That blend ratio is so key there because, you know, you have to be able to safely blend the hydrogen with the natural gas. And then you also have to factor it in with, as you said, the pipelines, and what about appliances that people have, and how do you retrofit pipelines for a blend that includes hydrogen? Are those big barriers for this energy creation?
There's certainly challenges, and you're right to think of all of those implications. The way the hydrogen would come to us is just as you stated. It would likely come initially as a blend of natural gas and hydrogen in pipelines. At about that 25% level, the engineering, the infrastructure that's in place can handle that blend. To go to higher and higher values will require likely modifications both at the user end and then also in the delivery end in the pipelines.
So tell us a little bit about how this project came to be, how it was funded, and how you were able to take these steps.
I'd be happy to. So from a funding perspective, WEC Energy Group funded this pilot of its own. So these aren't customer-funded dollars. We partnered with an entity called the Electric Power Research Institute. That's a national, international entity that is doing great work in setting the stage for what technologies are necessary as we transform our grid going forward. By partnering with Electric Power Research Institute and also the engines manufacturer, a Finnish company, Wärtsilä, we were able to design this demonstration, which is the largest grid-connected demonstration of this blending in the nation for this technology. We were able to demonstrate that we could get full output from the generator, that our emissions are what we expected. We expected to see the emissions of carbon dioxide go down. We expected all of the other engine controls to work, which they did. And then EPRI, at the end, will publish these results in the first quarter of next year, making them generally available to the whole industry.
Paul Spicer, Senior Vice President of Power Generation for We Energies and Wisconsin Public Service. We join in our conversation about hydrogen as a fuel source, as a blend with natural gas, the experiments underway for electric utility providers, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to experiments with hydrogen to generate electric power. The U.S. Department of Energy says hydrogen can be produced from a variety of resources like natural gas, as we've been talking about, nuclear power, renewables like solar and wind, making it an attractive fuel option for electricity generation. Join in on hydrogen power at the utility scale, 800-642-1234. Paul Spicer is here, Senior Vice President of Power Generation for We Energies and Wisconsin Public Service. Paul, WEC Energy Group has a goal of producing net zero carbon emissions from electric generation by 2050. How could burning hydrogen help reach this goal? What does hydrogen do to this goal?
Thanks for asking. By the time we get to 2050, we have a future with wind and solar pervasively around the grid. But what you find is that we need to be able to serve customers reliably, you know, every minute of every day. And there are periods of time where the wind isn't blowing, the sun isn't shining, and on-demand sources of energy need to be contributing to the grid. At a net zero carbon goal, those sources need to be running on a renewable fuel. Hydrogen, as everyone knows, hydrogen is very abundant. It's in water. It's the H2 and H2O. Electricity can be used to split that hydrogen molecule off from water. And then when we recombine it with oxygen, we can liberate energy to produce electricity. But that hydrogen being stored from the time that excess energy was available to split the water, if we recombine it when the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining, lets us bridge all of those times when we would need to provide electricity and the renewable sources are not available. So by getting to shift essentially that energy from one time to another, you can achieve a net carbon neutral by 2050.
Governor Evers announced a preliminary agreement with six other states to create a Midwest hub to pursue expanding production and access to green hydrogen, as we've been talking about. How could this collaboration, direct federal funds to Wisconsin for hydrogen energy products?
You're correct. State of Wisconsin, the Evers administration has actually a couple of different initiatives, one that you're stating. And a lot of that research, a lot of those federal dollars are going in on the side of the equation of getting the hydrogen infrastructure, its formation, its transportation, its storage set up. What WEC Energy Group was looking to do is be on the receiving end of it and say, with our obligation to receive or to provide reliable power, how would we need to be transforming our assets to receive that green hydrogen and produce electricity during those times when the renewable resources aren't available?
Let's go to Pete in La Crosse with a question. Pete, go ahead.
Right. Hey, I'm totally on board as far as hydrogen being added to the mix for utility scale electric generation. But I'm looking for some clarification that perhaps we are not talking about sending hydrogen in any fraction to our homes, but more so over the coming years, replacing our heat appliances, meaning furnaces, water heaters, electric ranges, cook stoves, et cetera.
Stoves, dryers. Yeah, and Pete, we're short on time. I want to get an answer here from Paul.
Yeah, I think you're correct, Pete. There's a couple different paths for in-home appliances. There are many that have a vision of electrifying the houses. And if we have many of those appliances running on electricity, then what we need to do is be able to have that grid be running zero carbon, which at that point, mixing or having hydrogen produce the electricity can then kind of power those resources. Because you're right, hydrogen being a much more volatile and small molecule is more challenging to handle, particularly at higher blends. So I share your long run concern.
Paul, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Paul Spicer is Senior Vice President of Power Generation for We Energies and Wisconsin Public Service, subsidiaries of Milwaukee-based WEC Energy Group. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now we learn about efforts to prevent injuries to animals and workers in meat processing, creating more humane slaughterhouse environments. UW River Falls is launching what it calls a first-of-its-kind training program. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, the USDA, in its livestock slaughter chart says roughly 4,800 million pounds of commercial red meat was produced in October, about the same as last year. Be part of this with your questions, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Kurt Vogel is an associate professor of livestock welfare and behavior at UW River Falls, where he directs the Humane Handling Institute. Kurt, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, Kate, it's great to join you this morning.
So you've launched or about to launch the Humane Handling Institute with coursework. Why is this training in the meat industry so important?
So since about 2014, the Animal Welfare Lab at UW River Falls has been tracking what we call humane handling enforcement actions, which are the documentation of violations of a law called the Humane Methods of Slaughter Act. The USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service enforces that law. That law has been in place since 1958. And it's focused on making sure that there's safe conditions for workers that are responsible for handling and stunning animals before they're slaughtered, as well as protecting the animals themselves from any sort of distress or suffering. So as we were tracking that data, we started to realize that there were some common threads that came through when it came to these violative actions, and that they seem to be preventable if we focused on training. So that's kind of what moved us in that direction.
And let's be mindful that we're, hearing this can be hard to think about. It can be hard to listen to. How does stunning work? Can you walk us through what that is?
Yeah, I can. So under the law, there are three means that are considered acceptable for stunning animals before they go into the rest of the slaughter process, the conversion from live animal to meat. And they include mechanical as well as chemical or electrical means. And at the core of these, they have to be rapidly effective, and they have to ensure that the animal's not going to wake up, because the core of good stunning practice on the front end of the slaughter process is to make sure that the animal doesn't experience a state of suffering. And so the stunning method will make sure that the animal is rendered unconscious and that they don't return to consciousness as we start that transition to meat.
What happens when stunning is done incorrectly? What is occurring there in these instances when it goes wrong?
When it goes wrong, that's a really difficult situation, because as you can imagine, that's a period of time where the animal can experience substantial suffering. In addition, the person that is doing that job will generally experience a substantial amount of anguish that goes along with that. So that's just the, I guess, the side of what the animal and the person that's directly involved in the event would experience. And then in addition to that, there are some regulatory processes that will play out. So the facility, the slaughter establishment or plant that's doing this work will have to stop production because the USDA inspector that's monitoring those procedures will have the ability to stop production. And then from there, it can be a short-term fix that happens if it's something that's quick and easy and the plant has a long track record of not having any stun failures. Or it could be a case where a plant is shut down for a period of days. So it all depends on the severity of the action and the history that the slaughter establishment has.
You mentioned the several methods of stunning captive bolts. One, gas, CO2 gas, and electrical, I think, are the three methods. Has the technology kept up with, humane handling? When you look at the technology and the science that's developed around slaughtering animals, has it kept up to the standards that are in effect by the federal government?
I think that if you look back historically, a lot of the early development of these stunning methods was sort of probably more art than science for quite some time, in the sense that it was more of like we try this, we see if it works. If it works, we stick with it. And what we're seeing now, especially over the last, oh, I'd say 3 decades or so, is a lot more focus on scientific validation of the stunning tools that we're using, and assessment of the response of the animal to the application of that stunning tool.
Because the stunning renders the animal insensible to pain and distress. I mean, that is what ideally that stunning situation is doing, right?
Yeah, that's the core objective. Like that is exactly what the goal is. Yes.
And then after the stunning, though, you have to bleed out the animal very quickly. Is there a connection there between humane slaughtering and being able to do that those steps quickly?
Yeah, there is. So that's all part of what would go into designing an effective stunning process in a slaughter establishment, is that we want to make sure that once, well, when the animal comes in and we are moving toward the slaughter process, one of the first steps we want to take is to effectively restrain the animal. So when we do this, we want to make sure that the animal is not in a state where they're distressed, but that they are kept still enough. In a lot of establishments that slaughter cattle, for example, they'll use a head restraint, so that'll hold the head still so they can effectively place their captive bolt stun. That head restraint is typically only held on for the amount of time it takes to place the stun. Then it's released. And this is usually a matter of seconds. So restraint is the first critical piece. That allows us to place an effective stun. Then effective stunning comes into play. We want to do that quickly after restraint so that the animal doesn't become distressed due to the restraint. After the stun is placed, we'll check to make sure that the animal is rendered unconscious. So we use some signs of sensibility to do that. Then after we check the signs of sensibility, then we'll quickly move to the exsanguination process, which is bleed out. So we want that piece to happen quickly, but not rushed and sloppy, if that kind of makes sense. So this is a critical piece where we want to make sure that the people that do that work are well trained, that they feel comfortable doing the work, and that they take a lot of pride in that work so that they do a good job every time.
I'm going to reintroduce you here. Kurt Vogel with us on the Humane Handling Institute, Associate Professor of Livestock Welfare and Behavior at UW River Falls. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Kurt, PETA and other critics of the meat industry have said there is no such thing as humane slaughter or humane meat. What is your response to that?
I think that this is something that societally we've got to watch play out over time. So the perspective I've kind of got on this is that we have here in our country about 32 million cattle and 132 million pigs that are slaughtered on an annual basis. And that shows that there's a substantial appetite in our society for meat. With that in mind, then, my objective during the time that I'm working is to try to help to make sure that as close to none of those animals as possible suffer in that process. There may be a time when we don't consume meat anymore as a society. I don't know when that would be. And that's something that will take a shift in ethic and general practice in how we choose our foods. So that's kind of looking bigger picture, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But then on an individual basis, this is something that people need to make choices on. You know, if you feel uncomfortable consuming animal products, then don't. It's important that we're able to make choices that we're comfortable with. And then live with those choices.
Along those lines, I mean, there are organizations that have a humane certification seal. And I mean, I've seen the logo on packaging for certain animal welfare standards through slaughter. Should we as consumers look for seals of approval like this?
I think that's a good idea. If we look across certification programs for animal welfare throughout animal agriculture in the U.S., one of the longest standing and most robust is our set of slaughter standards. So they were originally developed with guidance by Dr. Temple Grandin from Colorado State University in the early 1990s. And then they were adopted on a large scale by the meat industry in general and by customers to the meat industry over the late 90s into the early 2000s. This has been a program that's been around for quite a long time, and it's pretty effective. So I would say that if you're a consumer that is concerned with the welfare of animals that will make the meat that you eat, then one of the things to look for, yeah, would be some of the welfare labeling that's out there.
We have just a few seconds left, but how do you want this institute to grow in the future? Where do you see it headed?
So the focus of this institute is to serve as a place where we can train people in an environment that is more conducive to learning than trying to learn on the job in a slaughter establishment where things are moving fast. So that's our primary goal, is we want to make sure that we can provide a resource that helps to protect the well-being of animals that are entering slaughter facilities, because ethically we owe that to them. In addition, this will help to protect the welfare of the people that are doing the stunning work and handling work in these plants. And then in the longer term, this should help to contribute to improving the sustainability of animal agriculture in general, because a system is not sustainable that would cause pain and suffering. And so that's kind of our focus here.
Kurt, thank you for joining us.
Thanks. This was great.
Kurt Vogel is an associate professor of livestock welfare and behavior at UW-River Falls, director of the newly founded Humane Handling Institute. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.